right. Well, somebody who's was born ready, I suspect, is tonight's shapeshifter. The governance doyen, Mervyn King, senior counsel, former judge of the Supreme Court of South Africa. Hundreds of accolades from around the globe. He is probably, and maybe you can respond to this, Mervyn King, the preeminent thought leader on corporate governance around the world.
Sorry, Bruce, what did you... I didn't hear what you said. How did I respond to what?
The preeminent thought leader on corporate governance in the world. Is that a fair title to attach to you?
Well, that is what people say, and I accept it.
Excellent, good. Because otherwise, all of these accolades that you've received would be tragically wasted. When did corporate governance become a bee in your bonnet? Because you trained as a lawyer, became a senior counsel, you were a judge in the Supreme Court, all the while many companies and boards that you've sat on in Luxembourg and London and the JSE, including in the early days of the business that owns this radio station, Prime Media, you were on this board. Where did the governance bug bite?
Well, I think the government's bug bit me. Excuse me. It was in 1992 that the Institute of Directors, the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, and others, including Mr. Mandela, asked me to set up a committee to write guidelines for the majority of our fellow citizens who had not been in the mainstream of the economy, how to direct and how to manage. And I was thinking about doing it because at the time, as you said, I was chairman and director of several companies. And it was Mr. Mandela who eventually phoned me and said to me, he used to phone me and say, I knew when he wanted me to do a lot of work without remuneration, and say, how's my favorite judge? And he said that he thought I was the right person because I had a big commercial legal practice, and of course I'd been on the boards of companies. And so I set the committee up, but it's because of my knowledge that the world was, from a governance point of view, was shareholder-centric. Everybody was focused on the best interests of the shareholder, which was actually contrary to the common law, which was to act in the best interests of the company and not a particular stakeholder. But I knew that if we had come out with a governance model in 1994, when the first report came out, that was shareholder-centric, to translate that in today's language, white monopolistic capital, it would have been absolutely indigestible. So I actually steered my committee to come out with the first inclusive stakeholder model to take account of the legitimate and reasonable needs, interests, and expectations of stakeholders in the company, but always make a decision in the best interest of this incapacitated artificial person who has no body to be kicked, no soul to be damned, and has no conscience, the company. And that was the start, Bruce, in 92. The first report was in 94.
Were there early rumblings of corporate governance revolutions happening around the world at the time? I mean, you've been involved in helping so many countries and so many markets shape their corporate governance principles. Was there such a thing as corporate governance, a notion of corporate governance when you were starting out? Or did you help invent it?
There was, but it was in the context that scientifically, by the end of the 20th century, it was realized there had been a century of unsustainable development because we'd reached what is technically known as ecological overshoot, which means that companies, both public and private, had used natural assets faster than nature was regenerating them, clearly not a sustainable matter. And this led to a rethink at the United Nations. I was at the time chairman of the United Nations on governance and oversight, and also became chairman of the Global Reporting Initiative on Sustainability. And this led to a whole rethink on how the collective mind of the board should think. And so the board started looking at sustainability issues, and people started reporting in two silos. One was the financial statements, was obligatory. And then a lot of companies started doing sustainability reports, including Prime Media. And what happened in about 2007 at the United Nations, IFAC, the International Federation of Accountants, called a meeting. And they said, it was Chatham House rules in those days, but now it's public knowledge, that it's quite clear that reporting financially is critical, and there are two standards in the world, IFRS in this part of the world and US GAAP, but actually it's not sufficient. And I was able to say, as chairman of the United Nations and chairman of the Global Reporting Initiative, that sustainability reporting is critical in a resource-constrained world, but without numbers is quite meaningless. But I went on to say that it's actually divorced from reality to report in these two silos, because in the real world, companies operate on the basis that financial capital, natural capital, intellectual capital, social capital, all the sources of value creation and the relationships between the company and its stakeholders are integrated. Mm. And so started the thinking of integrated thinking and doing an integrated report. And it was agreed that the time had come for a new form of corporate reporting, known around the world as enhanced corporate reporting. And so the International Integrated Reporting Council was born, of which I became the chairman, and then the integrated reporting revolution started.
You led South Africa down the path of a principles approach to corporate governance, as opposed to the United Kingdom, and I think the United States, both driving more rules-based approaches. And the principles-based approach seems to have been less vulnerable to exploitation by nefarious forces, to put it politely, than perhaps the rules have. You give people rules, they find loopholes. In principles, there are no loopholes. And that was the thinking.
Exactly. As an experienced corporate lawyer, Bruce, I know that it's easier to get around a rule than a principle. And you're quite correct. As chairman, I directed my committee to come out eventually with a very outcomes-based, the King IV report is outcomes-based, influenced as I was with an outcomes-based approach at the IRC, the International Integrated Reporting Council, and also the Sustainability Development Goals of 2015, to which South Africa is a signatory, says, and I paraphrase, that business is at the junction of the economy, society, and the environment. And these three dimensions are absolutely critical to have sustainable development by 2030 in the 21st century. Otherwise, we may not have a sustainable planet by the end of the century.
Well, and that's the brutal reality. My guest this evening is Mervyn King, Judge Mervyn King, the man who put his name on South Africa's corporate governance codes, the man who has significantly influenced global thinking when it comes to financial reporting, to integrated reporting. Many, many titles to his name, many, many awards, many doctorates, many accolades given to him. South Africa's on the fourth version of the King Codes. We'll talk to him in just a moment. And I think he knows this question is going to come. How in this world, 25 years after corporate governance is treated seriously, things like a Steinhoff can happen. But that question coming up in a moment. Judge Mervyn King is our guest this evening. He's our shapeshifter. I recall Russell Lobsher, who's probably on your first, second, third, maybe even the fourth committee of helping to structure corporate governance standards in South Africa, former chief executive of the JSE. He told me a story of how he once went to go and see the chairman of a company who said, yeah, no, we've got great corporate governance. We have meetings all the time. And he essentially would call meetings with himself and he would propose resolutions. He would then vote on the resolutions and then approve the resolutions. And he was going through a process of what he thought was perfectly legitimate corporate governance. He never named the person. You may know the person. I don't know. he certainly wouldn't tell me. But that was the kind of Wild West that people thought was acceptable corporate governance 30 years ago.
Yes, absolutely. And I think social media has had a big role to play, Bruce. Radical transparency. We talk of shareholder activism, but today civil society activism is a greater disruptor than shareholder activism. If you look at shareholder activists at AGMs, they focus on the financial issues, where civil society looks at the totality of issues involved in the corporation. And so large companies, biggest companies in the world, Nestle, Coca-Cola, have all been affected by civil society movements and had to re-strategize on various issues. So it's a much greater disruptor. And consequently, governance And how you direct and how you manage has become a critical issue. The process has become important. And to have it as a mindless checklist is of no value. One needs a mindful approach and a value add to the decision-making process, hopefully coming out with better business judgment calls.
So in that context, people wonder how something like a Steinhoff happened.
Well, first of all, Steinhoff, remember the primary listing was in Frankfurt.
Yeah.
And so that is a two-tier board system with a supervisory board and at the bottom an executive board, a system with which I do not agree. I believe in a unitary board system where, as a chairman or fellow NED, you can eyeball the chief executive, the CFO or the COO, assuming there are three executives on the board. When you've got the two-tier board system, there's no eyeballing. You don't see body language. And you absolutely rely on what's in that pack. And then the question of skepticism arises. Now, skepticism is very important for a non-executive director. To be skeptical of something he reads, in other words, or people colloquially call it a red flag issue. But if a director is put on inquiry by anything, then he has a duty to inquire. Otherwise, the law is quite clear that he or she is entitled to rely on what's in the pack. The critical issue in Steinhoff is the executive board was a very experienced one. And did they, at any time, was there anything from a skeptical point of view? Were they put on inquiry? If they were, and they did not, well, that starts incurring liability, and that's going to be the critical issue also on the consolidation from the accounting point of view, because there's been a focus on the accounting irregularities. So on many of the subsidiary companies, there were audit opinions which were unconditional. So the top auditor on the consolidation, were they skeptical enough in accepting some of these audit opinions? These are some of the critical issues. And then a dangerous issue from a governance point of view is when one has a very dominant CEO and charismatic. I know Marcus Juster. Mm-hmm. If you may remember, I sat on the Josh Yador board.
Okay, well, that is a long time ago.
Yeah. And so...
Were you a skeptical non-executive at the time?
I was, absolutely.
Did that lead to a shorter term on the board than you might have had?
It's very interesting that going back some 10, 12 years, I actually, as chairman of the Coast Trading Group, appointed young David Sussman to become the chief executive of Josh Yador. Then eventually he became chairman. And I remained on as a NED. And so some 8-10 years ago, Marcus Juster actually approached us to reverse JD into Steinhoff. You may remember that, Bruce.
Yes, I do.
And I was a skeptical non-executive director. I was skeptical about it for various reasons. And funny enough, as recently as last night, I bumped into David Sussman, and he and I spoke about it last night, that he was, phrases carefully, irritated with me at the time. But he says, well, I was obviously, there was something in my wisdom. I regard myself as a person with a lot of experience, both academically and practically. I'm covered in what I call corporate scars. And when I ask questions and I get answers which I don't understand, I become skeptical.
When you look at a career in corporate governance, and you've handed over the reins of the King Committee now to Suresh Khanna, former chief executive at PwC, and he's going to take over those reins from you. I mean, how do you summarize what you have learned in a career that spanned the law, corporate law, sitting on the bench and being the judge overseeing cases, and then this remarkable global career in corporate governance?
Well, what I've learned, Bruce, is that the critical issue is do directors understand what's going on around here? So as chairman of companies, I used to, if there was a critical issue for the consideration by the board, I would always phone one of the NEDs and ask him or her to really research it in some detail, Google, Wikipedia, do whatever he or she wants to do. And when I raised the matter at the board meeting, I would ask that person to start the discussion. The reason for that is I wanted the discussion to start at a more informed level, not only on the 30-page management report. And hopefully and logically this leads to a more informed discussion and hopefully comes out with a more informed, better business judgment call. But then I never used to leave it at that. I used to go around the boardroom and say, well, it's quite clear. I think the meeting wants to resolve ABC. Is that agreed? Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yes, yes, yes. I would always pick on one director and say, will you please motivate to me in great detail why you voted yes? Now, if that director really understood the management report and hadn't understood the 45 minutes of discussion, he would sit there with two rows of teeth. But I can tell you, Bruce, I had a creative tension in my boardroom, and I know that my directors were more diligent and did their homework. So the chairman's role, what I've learnt is the chairman's role is critical. I also learnt, the chairman, you've got to be a bit arm's length. I learnt this with great pain and suffering when I had to get rid of a group chief executive in a company. And I'd been to his house for dinner, he'd been to my house for dinner. His wife and my wife played bridge together, and it was a painful exercise. And I learnt, as chairman, just keep a bit arm's length, although you've got to be collegiate, and it's not easy.
Mervyn King, what a privilege to have you in this evening. Thank you so much for coming in. Our shapeshifter this evening, the godfather of corporate governance globally, Mervyn King.